Welcome to Myeloma Crowd Radio, a show linking patients with myeloma researchers. We'd like to thank our episode sponsor, Celgene Corporation, for their support of the Myeloma Crowd Radio program. Now, we're excited about our show today, and before we get started with that, we'd like to share an update on our HealthTree product. We're still on our 50-city tour. We've been to 47 cities now, and we have over 700 patients using this tool that provides three key benefits to myeloma patients. First, it helps you understand personally relevant treatment options at every stage of disease, so whether you're newly diagnosed or relapsed, the system can help you understand what options might be available that you can discuss with your doctor. Number two, it helps you find clinical trials that you're eligible to join that are personally relevant as well. And three, it helps you find other patients that look like you with our reporting that's coming up. Importantly, we're a few days away from providing the ability to automatically upload your labs through our partnership with Apple using our HealthTree Connect app. And we're currently working on the researcher portal to provide both myeloma researchers and patients with reporting capability on anonymous data so we can share our myeloma stories. If you would like to join and share your myeloma story, you can go to www.healthtree.org and create an account. Now, our Myeloma Crowd show today is an important topic to many patients. Rather than focusing on a specific clinical trial, our topic is more broad in discussing African Americans and myeloma. And we realize that this is such a big community, they're twice as likely to get myeloma as white Americans. And so the Myeloma Crowd has started to develop programs specifically for this group. In the African American community, we now have a specific Facebook group that you are welcome to join. And we also have a program called Myeloma Meetups for the African American community to discuss specific topics, and in fact have one in Louisville coming up this Saturday. So we invite you to join those and take a look at the website to find those. We have with us today, our guest is Dr. Ashraf Bedros. Dr. Bedros has a long interest in the study of racial disparities in myeloma, and more than half of his patients are African American. And before I get to his formal introduction, I'd like to add that Dr. Bedros has spoken at two of our Myeloma Crowd roundtables, and his style is a very big hit with our patient audiences. So, Dr. Bedros, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us on Myeloma Crowd Radio.
Thank you, Jenny. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, let me give you a proper introduction for you first. Dr. Bedros is the director of the Multiple Myeloma Service and professor of medicine at the University of Maryland's Greenbaum Cancer Center in Baltimore. He's a native of Egypt who's completed his fellowship at George Washington University in Roswell Park. In addition to his research and clinical practice, Dr. Bedros is the author of hundreds of myeloma publications. He also reviews hematology articles from publications like the New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, Blood, Journal of Clinical Oncology, and many, many others. He also teaches plasma cell disorder lectures to medical students and helps fellows with their research and with their research rotations. His awards include being in the top 1% in medical school, an Excellence in Clinical Medicine Award, being in the top 1% of published authors in the field of hematology, a Humanitarian of the Year Award at the Mildred Mendel Cancer Foundation, a Teacher of the Year Award in the Department of Medicine, a Clinical Publication of the Year Award in the Department of Medicine. Dr. Bedros has led and collaborated on numerous studies examining disparities between African American and Caucasian patients in autologous stem cell transplants, cytogenetic abnormalities, and outcomes, and we'll touch on those studies in today's discussion. And remember, if you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Bedros, you can call 347-637-2631 and press 1 on your keypad. So, Dr. Bedros, let's just maybe have you give a broad overview and kind of a blunt question. Why should we care about myeloma in African Americans if we're not African American?
First, thank you for the excellent introduction. I hope I can meet the expectations of such a presentation. You correctly mentioned that African Americans are twice as likely to get multiple myeloma as Caucasians. And just as before I continue, I'd like to mention it's not just African American, it's actually black race. So people in Africa, in South America, do have higher incidence of multiple myeloma. not just African American. So if you look at the African American particularly, which is our talk today, they represent about 10% of the U.S. population approximately, and about 20% of the people living today with multiple myeloma are African Americans. Big problem we are having, and I think we all need to be conscious of, is the participation in clinical trials. We actually do not have enough African American in our clinical trials, and that probably will be discussed in more details later. More importantly, as a physician, I think the understanding of genomics between different populations is really a growing field and help us understand tumor biology. So trying to understand why a disease is more common in a specific population might help us understanding the pathogenesis of multiple myeloma. I think as a society, we owe it to African Americans to focus on their needs, on their expectations, and hopefully overcome the barriers that prevent access to care overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we want to make sure everyone has the same access and the same excellent care, especially from myeloma specialists like yourself. A converse question, I guess, would be why should African Americans who are not affected by myeloma care about myeloma? Because I know there's a lot more outreach now to black churches and things like that to kind of raise awareness about multiple myeloma in the black population.
You know, as we just mentioned, multiple myeloma in general is preceded by a benign stage called monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance. And this is an early stage of cancer that eventually progressed to multiple myeloma in about 1 to 2% of the patients, depending on the characteristics. And I think trying to understand that progression is crucial because we believe if we pick up this kind of early stage of myeloma before it causes end organ damage, we will be able to help patients instead of waiting for a fracture or kidney failure. We can prevent this disease early. And as I mentioned, this population has a higher risk of myeloma in general. And I think targeting them with screening, which is actually very simple blood work screening, is ongoing. And there are many studies trying to understand the progression from early disease to active myeloma. One of the issues that we face a lot in our clinics is family members. And as you probably know, multiple myeloma appears to be clustered in families. So anybody who gets multiple myeloma, we strongly recommend that they get their family members, especially first-degree members, screened because of the risk of progression to myeloma appears to be higher in this population.
And from what studies I've read, people who know they have this precursor condition, this MGUS condition, they actually live longer when they do progress with active myeloma.
That is correct. You pick the disease early, and you most of the time you can treat them before they develop extensive organ damage. So picking patients early is a huge focus for us now in myeloma community, especially looking at smoldering multiple myeloma where we can introduce treatment early on. There are many initiatives, famous as the Black Swan Initiative, trying to hopefully provide a cure for multiple myeloma if we treat patients early. And this clinical trial is ongoing across the country, and it's available in our center as well.
Oh, great. Man, I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't know, but what percent of patients, I've heard that a large percentage of black people in general in the elderly population have this precursor MGUS condition. Do you know the difference between the white population and the black population in the elderly that have MGUS?
As a whole, there was a big study, actually about 12,000 patients published by Ola Langren, and I believe the MGUS incidence in African American as a whole, not age specific, was about 3.5%, and Caucasians were in the 1.5%. We know as we grow older over age 50, about 5% of the population in the U.S. will have MGUS. I think African American, if we consider they are 2 to 1, so I expect if you divide it, you probably have a higher incidence, maybe up to 6-7%. But the number, exact number, is not at my fingertips at this point.
Yes, right. So we talked about the incidence of myeloma in the Black or African American community compared to other ethnicities. Do you want to go into, well, we'll talk about the genetics later, but in terms of disparities, what types of disparities are you seeing in treatment? Because many, many of your patients are Black, and you have a good read on what they're experiencing. Can you share a little bit about that?
I think the disparity in multiple myeloma is really two parts. Number one is the presentation. So we know that African-American patients present at a younger age. And in our study that we published, the median age was actually 10 years younger. Again, this is referral bias. If you look in the Sears data, it looks like they're somewhere about 5 to 6 years younger age. So if the median age of multiple myeloma is 69, if you look at white, it will be in the 71. If you look at African American, it will be about 65. So they are definitely presenting at younger age. The disease presentation itself is also variable. Many studies, and as well as ours, have shown that anemia is a common presentation in African American. Some of them in our center, for example, have more renal insufficiency. If you look at fractures and bone disease, it's actually more common in whites compared to Caucasians. If you look at cytogenetics, African-American in general present with more favorable risk compared to Caucasians, more translocations and hyperdiploidy, which is favorable risk factors for myeloma. So that's their presentation. The second part of disparity that we really deal with is referrals. We actually do not get African-American patients newly diagnosed or in early stages as we see with Caucasians. In our center, in our study, we noted that African-Americans get referred to a myeloma center for transplant with 12-month difference, so they are 1 year late coming to transplant compared to Caucasians. And this delayed referral for a transplant center has been reported in other studies as well. Why that bias, we don't know. It might be a physician-related bias, which is an issue that's being explored in many centers. But more importantly, it's probably socioeconomic and cultural. The third area of disparity is clinical trials. Most of the clinical trials in multiple myeloma have very low incidence of African-American participation. Actually, if you look across board, it's about 4% of the patients in myeloma trials that are published, for example, in New England are African-American. If you consider that 20% of the patients with multiple myeloma are African-American, that's a huge difference. That being said, we have to realize that most of those trials are done in Europe. If we focus on trials done in the U.S., like cooperative group trials, and I think Vince Rajkumar group just published on that, you find that the participation is a little bit higher, somewhere between 15 and 17%, depending on the trial, because a lot of African Americans do not want to go on new drugs. They like to go on established drugs that are used in combinations, or all of them are approved. And we deal with that in our clinics, and we can talk about how we deal with our clinical trial enrollment. So these are the disparities. It's presentation, it's referral, it's participation in clinical trials.
And how does myeloma compare with other cancers when it comes to these types of disparities?
So myeloma compared to other, as you know, I think there is a huge disparity for African Americans when it comes to cancer. We know that African Americans have the highest death rate in most cancers and also shorter survival in the U.S. In multiple myeloma, despite the fact they have higher incidence, we actually are lucky enough that their outcome is equal to Caucasians, if not better, if they received appropriate treatment. And probably that's one of the few malignancies where African Americans or Blacks do better than Caucasians as a disease. And I think that has been confirmed in many studies. And I refer to that a little bit with the favorable genomic profile of African Americans that appears to give them a better prognosis.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that next, actually, because there are different genetic features that patients can have. So they can have genes deleted on their myeloma cells, or genes added to their, you know, extra copies on their myeloma cells, or they can have a translocation where parts of the genes have swapped places, and those are called translocations. And so you're saying that typically when you look at a genetic profile of the entire population, the genetics are less aggressive, basically, for the African American or Black population than they are for the white population. Do you want to just explain what you see typically with patients in the clinic?
So
is it genetic or the studies that you've worked on?
When we looked at FISH analysis, which is a little bit more sensitive measure of evaluating chromosomal abnormalities in patients, most of the African American patients, and that has been confirmed in a larger studies we participated in with the Mayo Clinic group, showed that African American patients have more translocations, like 11-14, for example, which is a favorable marker, and also more hyperdiploidy. Very interestingly, they all have less deletion 17, and that has been detected in many studies. It's clear that deletion 17 is this unfortunate marker to pertain tumor resistance, and patients usually have very short remissions. And in African American, this particular abnormality is much less common than Caucasians. This is using a chromosome analysis in the clinic, which is what we focus on. Using more sophisticated techniques, such as genome sequencing, whole genome sequencing, which gives a little bit higher resolution to look at the whole picture of the somatic mutations and genomic rearrangements. If you do that, you actually surprisingly find that African Americans have more mutations than what we see in Caucasians. Again, mostly involving translocations in the B cell area, and lower risk of lower incidence of high risk genomics. There is a lot of interest in SNP analysis, which is a single nucleotide polymorphism. It's a little bit more sophisticated way. It's basically a SNP, or this polymorphism is the genetic control genetic variations between individuals. You can think of SNP as building blocks between the DNA and the gene, and there are millions of them, and specific changes in this particular blocks that occur between individuals can put you at susceptibility to multiple myeloma. And Wendy Kozan from California has actually pioneered this work and published about differences between African American and Caucasians, and she has identified specific variants. I think there were 16 variants she reported in Caucasians, and 8 of them were found in African American, that actually increased the susceptibility to developing multiple myeloma. Again, this is a developing field, and if you follow this field, it changes every couple of years. But it's clearly that I think there is a genetic predisposition for African American, and that's different than what we described in the FISH analysis, which occurs in the tumor itself after it develops. I hope that's clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple. Maybe it's not.
No, it is, and I just have some follow-up questions. So,
okay.
can you explain hyperdiploidy for people who don't know what that is?
Hyperdiploidy is extra copies of chromosomes. So our cell have 44 and XY, and if you start having extra copies of chromosome, and interestingly in myeloma, the extra copies are usually the odd number chromosomes. So you have extra copies of chromosome 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, etc. And we know that patients that present with this hyperdiploidy, at least in some studies, do have favorable prognosis. And that's what we describe as hyperdiploidy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about the genetics, I know some studies have been done, like you said, to study other cultures, to see if the genetics were similar or if it was just maybe an environmental thing here in the United States. Can you describe what research has been done about that and what they found?
I think this cross-population or cross-cultural genomics is a starting field, and I think in multiple myeloma, you need a lot of databases to be able to do this kind of genomics to discover differences. And I think this field just starting, and I think we can say that I think the influence of environment on developing multiple myeloma has become less and less appealing as a possibility for developing myeloma in favor of genomic predisposition that can be found in early stages. And even in Africa, I believe some studies have done as well, especially in West Africa, looking at that from big registries. So genomics do affect and molecular oscillation and mutations do affect the disease, and I think I really don't have specific studies to quote except what has been done in the U.S., so I'm not sure about Japanese, for example, or Chinese, but I'm sure these studies also will be very helpful. These populations, by the way, do have less incidence of multiple myeloma, those races, again, for unclear reasons.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I remember seeing a study that was just showing that the genomics of the African population was very similar to the genomics of the Black U.S. population. So
that
what you're saying overall, yeah, what you're saying overall is that they have more translocations, but they're lower risk. They have more hyperdiploidy, which is lower risk. So ultimately, they should be living longer. And are they?
That is correct. If you look at the Sears database, African Americans live a little bit longer than Caucasians. And in our study, for example, despite the fact African Americans are referred to transplant a year later, if you look at their survival from the time of transplant, it's equal to Caucasians. But if you look at survival from the time of diagnosis, it's a year extra. So I think there is a clear signal now that African American might have a favorable or at best, or maybe at least equal outcome to Caucasians. And that is different than the previous reports that has been reported 20 years ago suggesting that African Americans do poorly with multiple myeloma. And I think they do poorly if they don't get adequate treatment. But if they are provided equal treatment, they do as well, if not better.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that it's been kind of a challenge to study this population and gather all the information that's needed. If you had a magic wand and could wave it over participation in some of these even observational type studies or studies that don't even involve treatment, what would you wish for?
I think a big part of the problem is trust in the medical system. I think African Americans over the years have been hurt by the medical system for many reasons, and they felt lack of caring from certain institutions, lack of respect from physicians, and I think gaining their trust is crucial. I always remember when I moved to University of Maryland, which has a large African-American population. About 40% of our patients are African-American. Again, that's geographic because Baltimore is about 60% African-American and Washington next door is 50%, which is our referral base. I saw a young woman. She was 29-year-old, and I saw her in the hospital with a cord compression and paralyzed. This woman for 3 years has been complaining of back pain, going to different physicians. And each one of them say, you need to lose weight. She was a little bit overweight. It's your weight. Nobody took her complaint seriously to investigate it until she became paralyzed. I think you can imagine
go
in and tell her, I have a treatment for you, how long it took her to trust me. It took her years. She actually did well, recovered her cord function, and eventually actually went on a clinical trial. And I think I will never forget what she told me. She told me, all what I needed is someone to respect me and not look at me, and I hate to say what I'm going to say, but I will say it, as a big, fat, stupid black woman. And I always remember that. You need to respect your patients. You need to be honest with them.
Yeah.
Presenting data to patients in a very straightforward manner, this is your options. I think this clinical trial will help you. It's a new drug. This is the benefits. This is the pluses and minuses. And accept what the patient would say. Some patients say, you know, I can't go on this clinical trial, and that is okay. We have to respect their decision. Each patient is a big partner of this journey, and he determines his or her selected treatment course. Our job is to guide them. Some institutions, if you don't go on their clinical trial, they tell you, okay, really, you can go in the community to be treated. And I think that kind of approach needs to change. So as a physicians, we have to change our approach. The second thing that I noted in our patients, as I mentioned, they trust you, they will listen to you, and they will be open to understand what you are saying. If they don't trust you, little is done. And that's not just African-American, it's Caucasians as well. So I think these are the two things. I hope that patients can understand. We have actually, we have done, as you know, we have done some observational studies. Like we developed an observational study for osteonecrosis of the jaw because we diagnosed this condition here and I wanted to follow 200 patients. And I think patients agreed to participate, agreed to give samples, agreed to give all of that because they felt they understood the problem, they understood what benefit they will get even from an observational study, not just a treatment study. So I think understanding where they come from is crucial, and our success is shown in our publications, all my investigator-initiated trials and our trials in the University of Maryland. We have about 35 to 40% African-American enrollment, and that's more than double the national average.
Oh, that's terrific. That's wonderful. Let's go back to what you were saying, trust in the system and trusting your doctors. I think there's sufficient reason for them to be distrustful based on things like Tuskegee and the Henrietta Lacks and things like that. So how do we go about changing that? Because I think it's really an intolerable thing today to see those types of things happen. I don't think it happens anymore. So how do we regain the trust for this community in myeloma researchers in general, in doctors who want to refer, and to this process? What do you think would help?
I think understanding where patients come from and basically helping them understand the disease, give them your treatment options, and respect whatever decision they make is the beginning. I think trust is a journey. That starts with the first time I meet patients, and some patients will express their skepticism and, I heard that transplant's not important. Why are you recommending it? I heard this treatment's not important. Why are you suggesting that instead of that? And I think answering patient questions, understanding where they come from is crucial. But to build back the trust that deteriorated over decades of both medical and society aggression against African-American is a very complicated matter. Actually, most of it is probably beyond my understanding. I just deal on a very limited scope with whoever comes my way, and I try to do my best. And we succeed with many. I think that's what I can say. Just try.
A question to follow up on that, what you just said about transplant. Have you studied or looked at transplant in the African-American community and its impact? Is it more impactful, less impactful than other ethnicities?
We actually, we published on that maybe a couple of years ago now. We actually looked at the largest African-American population in our center to have reported. We looked at about 170 African-American patients, maybe more, maybe 175, and compared their outcome and characteristics to Caucasians that came to our center. And the results confirm that we do have problem with referral pattern. As I said, they get referred later to transplant. They have equal outcome. So their survival is identical to for Caucasians after transplant and longer if you look from the time of diagnosis. Unfortunately, this kind of studies in our center and other centers does have its own bias, because most of the patients that don't have insurance or do not want to come to a tertiary center will not be counted. And this group of patients we have no access to, so we don't know what happens. But if they come to transplant, they do very well. Overcoming this problem, a lot of people tried, like Asher Khan, looking at SEER Medicare database to look at African American and those particular in this registry. And they noted that the same thing, African American usually are referred a little bit later to transplant. The problem with this particular data set is we are missing the young African American, because Medicare database starts for older patients. And as I said, African Americans present at a younger age. So there is this younger age that we are missing. The other observation that I just remembered is most of our transplanted patients, 70% of them, are African-American females. So we are missing a lot of males. If you correctly probably know that myeloma is more common in men than women, and African-American men has the highest risk. I think it's 14 or 15 per 100,000. So we are talking about missing a big chunk of the patient that will benefit from this treatment. And again, that's socioeconomic, cultural issues besides medical issues that are mostly beyond really my understanding.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about transplant, I know there are a lot of studies running early transplant versus late transplant. And if these patients are getting transplant a year later than other patients, but they're having better outcomes, would it be a good hypothesis to say if the transplant came even earlier, then these patients could really boost their longevity?
I think that's a good hypothesis, but I just want to, I'm glad you mentioned that, because standard of care for multiple myeloma is to receive induction, and then once you are in remission, you go for transplant. In the African-American community, what we have seen in our center is you get induction, your physician in the community tell you transplant, it's this, that, oh, I don't want transplant. So you stay on Velcade, Revlimid, Dex for about 12 months. You progress. You go on another line of therapy. You go back in remission, and then you see us. So we are seeing a lot of salvage transplant in this population, not upfront transplant. And there is a big difference in outcome, as you know, between salvage transplant and upfront transplant. And your point is correct. We should be doing more upfront transplant to have the maximum benefit of it. Salvage transplant is beneficial, but it's associated with less progression-free survival, and definitely that's a modality that is for upfront. If trials established, and they are ongoing, that salvage transplant have the same impact on patient survival as upfront transplant, maybe we can consider both of them equal. But as of now, upfront transplant is the standard of care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And I think, yeah, as more data comes in and that gets more clear with more patients, I think that would be great. But I understand the need for an upfront transplant and why you would want to do that, to kind of stay off the myeloma for as long as possible with the most powerful therapy that you can administer. And it's not a fun procedure, but it's very doable for patients. So when you were talking about African American men,
before we leave that point, if I can clarify, as we become more sophisticated in our way to measure multiple myeloma disease as a disease, for example, nowadays everybody's doing minimal residual disease assessment, which can pick up one cancer cell in a million, and I think Nikhil Munshi and others and the French have shown that you can actually have a better and improved overall survival and maybe progression-free survival if you are MRD negative. And maybe in the next wave of trials that are ongoing, we are going to say if you are MRD negative, whichever way you reach that negativity, whether through a transplant or carfilzomib induction or Velcade induction, your outcome will more or less be the same. We know that transplant gives you more MRD negativity, and we know that certain treatments are improving this MRD negativity to actually higher percentage of patients. So that might be a surrogate marker that will be in the clinic soon to help guide patients who should go for transplant now and who is an MRD negative that maybe we can wait on transplant. This is an area of debate, and I know a lot of people are trying to make decisions on that. So far, as I just said, we don't have the trials to establish the clinical applicability of that. The data are promising, but we don't have trials yet to make a decision on going to transplant or delay transplant by MRD negativity. But the data is coming along, and maybe in a couple of years we will be able to make clinical decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be wonderful when that comes, because then you can more personalize therapy, how long and which therapies do you choose. And, I mean, that's very difficult right now, in my opinion, for you all as researchers and clinicians.
Yes.
So going back to what you were saying with the 70% of African-American females in the study, but African-American men having the highest risk, do you see a difference in either willingness to participate in studies or you said there were some differences. What are those differences, and how do we help the people that need it the most, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And what are the barriers that are preventing this?
This observation has been reported in our center also for leukemia trials, where we noted participation of African-American men is at a lower percentage compared to the females. I don't know what is the exact cause of that, but I will come to the point that it's probably a complex process, and this is inequality in social situations. A lot of them are, cannot come to transplant because they have nobody to help them or care for them. A lot of them will have economic barriers. They cannot take months to go for transplant. Some of them don't carry health insurance. And as I said, there is some bias from physicians as well as bias from the patients. They just don't want to do anything that will affect their quality of life. I think a good number of patients, we started to actually, for unclear reasons, in the last couple of months, I have seen a lot of Jehovah's Witness patients, and it's very difficult to offer them transplant. You have to be very careful giving them treatment because of the drop in the counts, because they will not accept blood transfusions and platelets, and we have to respect that, and we have to tailor the treatment for them. And some of them just say, I will not get treatment. It's not unusual to see a myeloma patient come my way and say, okay, thank you, I will not get treated. We see that infrequently. So there are many factors, and it is a more complicated issue. The good news is if people come to the medical system and get hooked up with us and get treated, the outcome will be good. And I think that's really the message that should come out. The question is, should you come, should you trust the system, should you go to different opinions or have two or three opinions to help you. As you correctly mentioned, patients treated in myeloma centers or myeloma people with myeloma expertise usually do better than people that are treated in the community. And I think that's our job, is to try to reach those patients and try to explain that we can help them, hopefully understand where they are and give them options.
Mm-hmm. And I think I want to stress this point because even though, like most of us, I would say most of us get diagnosed in a general oncologist setting. So we're going to a hospital, we don't know what's wrong with us, we're having back pain or whatever. And we go to our local doctor who guides us to a hematologist or an oncologist and says, oh, you have myeloma, so of course we're going to start treating you. It's really, really important for myeloma patients to seek out a myeloma specialist. Because if you can imagine, these doctors are treating patients with breast cancer and colon cancer and lung cancer and kidney cancer and liver cancer and all sorts of cancers. And in my opinion, the advances that are happening in multiple myeloma are so fast and so nuanced that it's going to be impossible for somebody like this, no matter how much you love your doctor, to understand myeloma at the depth that it needs to be understood. So in my opinion, and the data shows that too, like the University of North Carolina did a study that showed if you saw a myeloma specialist within the first year of your treatment, you live 39% longer. And the Mayo Clinic did a similar study that shows you live 2 years longer for patients who are seen at centers that have more than a certain, like more than like 15 or 10 myeloma patients. So it's the depth of experience that you have is unparalleled and really amazing. And patients can take advantage of your deep expertise and get better care.
And I know we hope that, you know, most patients that come to us for a second opinion, most of them will go back to the referring physician. We don't keep patients in our center. We do transplant here. If they go on a clinical trial, they stay with us. But I would say that more than 60-70% of the patients will be back to their physicians, managed close to home and in easier parking, easier access, but just to supervise the treatment even from a distance, that can be very helpful. And I hope we can reach more patients to provide this service.
Well, that's a really nice partnership because they could go to you when they're trying to make a treatment decision or kind of watch periodically their status, and then you can flag things that might come up early and say, hey, you might want to consider doing this or this, and then they can go back to their center and go get all their infusions and all their lab tests and all that where it's more convenient at home. So I think a lot of patients do that. It's very common, and patients shouldn't shy away from doing that.
No, I know, and a big barrier to that is going to be the socioeconomic status of the patient.
Yeah.
If they are able to do that, if they have the income, the background, and occupation. As you know, many studies link those factors to outcome in myeloma in general, and I think the outcome is related not to the genetic disease, but to the access to better care, especially the African, especially in African American population.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So according to the NCI Sears statistics, and you mentioned some of these before, in 1998, a little more than 8 black males per 1,000 were diagnosed with myeloma, and today it's 15.9 black males per 1,000. And for black women, it's 11.6, and for the general population, it's 6.7. So if you interpret, so some people might interpret those numbers and see the incidence of myeloma increasing, especially among African Americans. But do you think that's better diagnosis methods, not an increase in risk, or how does your experience inform you about these types of issues and how should we as patients think about them?
You know, the incidence of multiple myeloma at that particular time frame was about 21,000-22,000. Today, the incidence of multiple myeloma is 30,000. So I think there is increased detection, and I think with increasing detection, African-American who has doubled the incidence numbers did increase. The only increase that I'm aware of from Sears database includes the young population. We know that there is increased incidence of multiple myeloma in patients younger than age 60, but all other groups are more or less unchanged. And you correctly mentioned, I think, more awareness of the disease. More physicians are checking more for SPEP and free light chains, and that helped diagnose more patients early on. And that is definitely a factor, our technology in detecting these conditions and the awareness.
Mm-hmm. You think it's longer life, too, because I think we're keeping you are keeping myeloma patients alive for a longer period of time. And I think that's probably a rise in incidence, right? Because, well, maybe not incidence, but just number of people that have myeloma.
Yeah. It's called prevalence, yeah. So incidence is the new cases occurring every year, and that's
right.
On the right. But you're right, the prevalence, people living with multiple myeloma as a whole, is also increasing. And that's related to the newer treatments. You know, the median survival of multiple myeloma in the same time frame in 1998, which you mentioned, was about 3 years with transplant and with all what we have. Today, the median survival is probably approaching 10 years. I think last data was 7 years, and I think that will be increasing in the next couple of years due to introduction of newer drugs and immune therapy and CAR T cells. So all this technology and developments really had a huge impact on myeloma patients. I don't think there is any other malignancy where survival has tripled in a decade like multiple myeloma.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think I made an error saying per 1,000, but it's per 100,000. So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
I need to make a correction there.
Yeah.
So you have performed a lot of research. I don't know if this is the – I know you had an article or a study that you cited in Blood last year, which found some differences between different categories of patients. Is that the study that you were mentioning earlier, or do you want to share any studies that you've been working on or clinical trials that you've been working on that to study this field in particular?
We published in Cancer on the disparity between black and white patients with regard to transplant, and we have a couple of abstracts presented over the last couple of years, as you correctly mentioned, looking at FISH abnormalities or cytogenetic signatures. This year we're trying to study actually weight and BMI or obesity and in different groups with multiple myeloma. You probably know that patients that are obese or have different differences in lifestyle can affect myeloma incidence. There are enough studies to say that obesity affects incidence of myeloma. It's very unclear if this is a African-American related issue or just obesity in general. There are some studies looking into that. But I think I will take it as the broader spectrum differences in lifestyle do affect the incidence of multiple myeloma. The last thing we are really interested in and looking at the moment is familial multiple myeloma. We actually identified 18 families in my practice that have a first-degree member with multiple myeloma. Some of them actually have two or three. And those are quite intriguing because we always... And that's why I'm saying I think there is a genetic predisposition to multiple myeloma that is becoming more and more clear as we study SNP and whole genome sequencing. And that has been established as well. So familial multiple myeloma is much more common in black. So if you look at our population, those 18 patients, 16 or 15 of them actually, 15 of them are African-American. And the literature has established that. So first-degree relatives, being a man, presenting early age of multiple myeloma, increase your familial risk for myeloma. And it's interesting when you start seeing patients and their family members having the disease that it's indicating some kind of a genetic predisposition, not just environment, which has been the idea, or lifestyle issues. Mm-hmm. So that's an area I think is crucial and probably help us understand more the genomic landscape of multiple myeloma. We ended up with a couple of twins, actually, with multiple myeloma. And the reason we do that is we check the twin for a transplant, and you find that, oh, his family member has MGUS or has lymphoma or has myeloma. So we are paying attention to that a little bit more closely, and hopefully we'll be able to publish this data once we have a little bit more information.
And is it an open observational study that somebody can join at your clinic, or are you looking at patients just who are being seen in your clinic and kind of retrospective data? Is there something that patients can join and do?
I think so far we have been doing this by observation, and every time we see a patient, we definitely check their history, and if the family member is around, we try to get samples from them to see if it's the same IgG when they present, so get their history. But I think starting a prospective data, and I think there is a lot of interest in that, I believe Stand Up to Cancer, Irene Gabriel is trying to do something similar. Look at high-risk patients to look at the incidence of early myeloma, because I think these family members, if we can pick up myeloma in them early, we definitely can prevent complications. And as you correctly mentioned, hopefully have a longer survival. So we have not done that in our center prospectively, but this is something we definitely like to pursue, and especially in our African-American population, because very few prospective studies, observation studies, have been performed in African-American patients.
Yeah, and I just want to stress that point, I guess. So Dr. Gobriel's study, I think it opens on October 15th or so, and family members or patients with family members who have it can join also. And so can the African-American community to see what's the family incidence and is this a family genetics thing. There's a difference between an observational clinical trial and a treatment clinical trial. Do you want to just give a quick review of the difference between those two, because the observational studies are really easy to join?
There are many observational studies. Like, we have done a couple of observational studies in our center looking for osteonecrosis of the jaw. We followed what you can, which is a complication in multiple myeloma patients receiving bone strengthening substances like bisphosphonates and RANK ligand inhibitor like Xgeva. We wanted to know the actual incidence, not just look at cases. As you know, in the literature, you find, a case here, a case there. So we wanted to look at the high-risk patients and see who will develop that condition. And we followed patients for 2 years. Every 6 months they come to see us, we obtain blood samples and saliva samples. Nothing extra. Patients come to get blood, to give blood to obtain myeloma staging, and at the same time we take part of that for the research studies that we are doing. And this was an observational study, and it doesn't require much from patients. But actually, to my surprise, almost half the patients by the 1 year dropped out of the study. They just don't want this kind of extra work that they don't think will directly help. And that's different than the clinical trials or trials with drugs, which includes randomization, some trials, or phase one or two trials. And I think most of your audience probably know the difference between different trials. And participation is different. Phase one trials are usually for later stages. Randomized trials where you can get the drug or not get the drug are usually for established patients and trying to establish FDA approval. And this kind of trials usually introduce newer treatments for patients. And you probably know that participation is very low in the African-American community.
Right. Well, I know we've talked about a lot of these aspects, but maybe a summary question before I open it up to a caller questions would be, really, how would myeloma research and treatment be different, in your opinion, if African-American participation levels in support groups, clinical trials, specialty referrals would become at the same rate of the rest of myeloma patients, if everything were as optimal and better than what they should be? So how do you think patients today might benefit?
I think it is a huge issue for African-American community to participate in clinical trials. We know that genetic groups or racial groups act differently to different drugs. If we take Velcade, for example, or bortezomib, we know that the incidence of peripheral neuropathy in African-American patients is much higher than what's reported in Caucasians. We didn't know that from the clinical trials because participation of African-American on the initial studies was very low. But in our center, when we treated patients, we reported on that. We reported on the painful peripheral neuropathy that occurs more in African-American. The same with Japanese, for example. When Velcade was introduced, we know that all of a sudden there were people in Asian families started having pulmonary complications and hemorrhage or pneumonitis with Velcade, which has never been reported in the initial trials in the U.S. So what I'm trying to say is participation in trials give us better understanding of how drugs act in different racial groups. And actually, more importantly for patients, is they get newer drugs first. For example, if you want to get a CAR T-cell today, which I know is very hot and everybody wants to get it, even newly diagnosed patients, the only way to get it is to go on a clinical trial. The problem is when the drug or the treatment modality is not publicized enough, people don't want to do it. I remember when we opened the carfilzomib trials before its approval, you have to tell patients this is an effective treatment, please take it. And some patients will say, yes, I don't have any options, or I would like to try that and leave my options for later, because that's always a debate. When should I go on a clinical trial? I think you should go on a clinical trial if it's promising, if it has some efficacy, to better leave the other options for later on. You can get daratumumab at any time, but you can try this drug up front. Nowadays, most trials, really driven by patients, require patients to be refractory to everything. So you have received all the myeloma treatments, and now if you have no options, we can offer you the BCMA antibody trial or the CAR T cells, and that's where the field is going. So I think participation of African Americans will give us signal for what's going on and will provide them with treatment that otherwise will not be available to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much hope and promise because you could really, by studying the genetics, by having participation in the clinical trial, you could really identify a particular treatment that might work better for this population than others. Like you gave the example that a lot of these patients have the 1114 translocation, and now we know that venetoclax might work particularly well for this population. So if you're able to do these types of studies, you can say, oh, wow, the optimal path for a patient that looks like this with these types of genetics for this racial profile looks like this, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I think studying those cases in more detail is very much the way we are heading. You correctly stated that 1114, probably in a couple of years, this multiple myeloma, which we know all of us, it's very heterogeneous disease, we will be able to actually say, you know, 1114 myeloma gets treated this way, 17P myeloma gets treated this way, double hit myeloma, which is the new definition, meaning myeloma with two abnormalities like 17 deletion and 414 translocation, get treated this way. And until that happens, the only way it will happen, actually, if we start doing trials looking at those patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to leave a few minutes for caller questions, and this is just such an informative and valuable show. We have a caller in the studio, but I can't see the phone number, so if you hear something in your handset, I'm adding you on, and we'll invite you to ask your question to Dr. Bedros. Hi there. Are you online?
Hi, Jenny. It's Dana Holmes. I'm sorry, I forgot to unblock my number. I was calling from an office phone. Thank you. Yes. Hi, Dr. Bedros. How are you? Thanks so much for doing Jenny's show. We just love these interviews because it really gives us patients the opportunity to connect with amazing specialists such as yourself. So thank you for taking the time this morning. Yes. Dr. Bedros, how with younger patients? I know whenever I read that younger, I often wonder if I fit the bill because I just turned 61 and I think to myself, well, I've got to be a senior patient and I'm still smoldering. So I'm often confused by that whole idea of 65 and under or 60 and under is considered a younger patient. Why is that?
I think 61 is young, and I'm glad you feel young. But actually, when we talk about young and multiple myeloma, we're really talking about patients less than age 50. And this population,
okay,
I think in my mind, is a little bit different. And as I said, they are increasing in number. Some of them, independent of African American or Caucasians, do have very aggressive presentations. We haven't published that yet, but we will. For example, plasma cell leukemia, primary plasma cell leukemia, which is a very aggressive form of myeloma at presentation, very rare, is clustered in younger patients less than age 50. So they might have a little bit of a different presentation. At the same line, younger patients that present with a standard multiple myeloma will do very well if gets treated aggressively, and those patients can be treated aggressively and they have longer survival. So it comes down to the biology of the disease, and I think younger patients might have a biologically different myeloma than older patients.
That's interesting. You know, Jenny has these Facebook groups, and she has a lot of she has general groups for everybody to join, and then she created these smaller subgroups, and there's a group for under eight patients under 50, and then we just created one for patients under 40. You know, you don't think of it in that age population, and a lot of those patients have a very, very difficult time getting the actual diagnosis because they don't fit the demographics. They don't fit, you know, they go to a doctor, and that's the last thing that they're thinking about is testing them for myeloma because of the age.
And that's actually, you know, this point is very important because I just mentioned about the example of the young woman that came to our way. But we have in our center at the moment patients in their 20s. We have about three or four of them. Oh. And they take a longer time to diagnose. We don't think of myeloma at age 28 or 26, but we are seeing those patients. And I think more awareness on the physician side. One of those patients diagnosed herself. She said, I have high calcium and back pain.
Wow.
She went to put it in Google, and Dr. Google told her myeloma is one of those cases. So she came to see us. Actually, she refers herself, said, I think I have myeloma. And I usually don't see these patients, but she insisted I see her. And she was right. She has non-secretory myeloma that is causing a tumor on the spine that we biopsied and established. So what I'm saying is sometimes you're right, it's not easy, but I would like to go back to patients that are younger and they have questions, and experience of the center makes a difference in helping
them. Absolutely. We actually had a member in one of our groups. She was the mom of a young boy who was diagnosed at 13 years old, and he passed away at 18, but he had multiple myeloma, and he was being treated for it. We were astounded by that I just the thought of it. How does a young person actually even develop it? You know, and I wondered, and I was listening to what you said, that perhaps there is a genetic component to it somewhere along the line, because it just doesn't make sense to realize that this is an older person's disease, yet we're seeing these.
It is very rare in this age group, less than 20. It's really rare. You find those as case reports, and they are really, really rare. And a lot of times they are confused with lymphoma and myeloma, becomes difficult to diagnose.
Right.
So they are out there, yes.
So how do we interpret survival trends for the younger myeloma population? Because, you know, you read these survival trends, and it's generally the older patient population that they're studying. So how would a young patient actually look at that and sort that through? Or doesn't that matter? Does it matter mostly what your disease biology is at the onset?
I think most of the myeloma survival is dependent on disease biology, but also on treatment delivered. And the improvement in survival is occurring across all age groups. That being said, as I said, there is a subset of patients that might have an aggressive presentation that is biologically dictated. Like we know that patients with deletion 17, for example, if it's present in more than 60% of the myeloma cells, will be a detrimental factor for survival. Most of those patients have a median survival of about 2 years, irrespective of the treatment given. So sometimes when the biology is very aggressive, it doesn't matter what treatment you give. But most of the time, 80-90% of the myeloma patients that present with regular myeloma get treated. They have improvement in survival over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And you are a site for the ASCENT trial, is that correct? Is the University of Maryland a participating site? Yeah.
Yes.
So that's terrific. So you, I would think, because you do have a large representation of the African American population, will likely have patients that you could enroll into the ASCENT trial to make that a more well-balanced trial, I would think. Have you enrolled anyone yet?
I think the trial opened nationally, and I think we enrolled the first patient last week, and we have another patient coming in a couple of weeks. So we have two patients on the study.
In your center?
Yeah, yes.
That's exciting. That's exciting. Thank you for doing that work. You know, the smoldering myeloma patient population are really, we're keeping our eye on that for sure. And I just wanted to ask one last question concerning MRD testing. I think what really always puzzles me is the idea of them taking a small sample from your bone marrow biopsy or from your bone marrow and testing just that particular sample to determine MRD positive or negativity. Because I'm thinking that it cannot be a full representation of the entire marrow, just that one spot. Or is it assumed that if you have an MRD negative finding, that particular sample is representative of the entire marrow?
I think, as I just mentioned, MRD negativity is becoming, it's still a research tool. Most of the decisions should be done on a clinical trial. There are some caveats to the MRD negativity. You mentioned one of them. This is a representative of the bone marrow, and we believe it is the bone marrow in general. But there are three problems with it in my mind. Number one, patients who present with MGUS or smoldering myeloma and progress to multiple myeloma, a lot of those patients, when we treat them, we get rid of the myeloma clone or the aggressive clone, and we go back to the MGUS stage. And those patients will have an M spike of 0.1 about 4-5% plasma cells in the bone marrow, so they are MRD positive. But they have the same progression-free survival and overall survival as myeloma in complete remission. So despite the fact they are not MRD negative, they do very well. On the other hand, if you do correctly, as you mentioned, myeloma can spread to other sites. Let's say that you have a plasma cytoma or a tumor make of plasma cells in the thoracic spine, and we did the biopsy on the iliac bone, we will miss that area. That's why now we are combining MRD negativity with a PET CT scan to see if there's any activity outside. So the story is developing. I don't think we have an answer yet, as I just said, and I just want that to be clear because I get that question a lot. It's not ready for prime time and saying, okay, let's take it and make decisions on it. Decisions should be done on a clinical trial. And
okay.
Last, one read of MRD, meaning doing MRD today, is not a representative. What's more important is repeating the MRD. So the question is, should we repeat it in 6 months? Should we repeat it in a year? How many negatives do you need to call it really negative? And again, those answers are not out there.
Yeah, so we're still years away from probably seeing really true, I guess the guidelines, the real book that somebody could open in the manual and say, okay, this is how we do it. So, yeah,
I
well, thank you.
I think we can do it doesn't mean we should act on it. We can do a lot of things
right.
In medicine, but most of them we should think twice before we act on them.
Right. Now, you brought up a very good point about treating, let's say, a smoldering myeloma patient early and wiping out the more aggressive clone. Could the opposite happen with earlier treatment? In other words, could you end up treating just the non-aggressive, the less aggressive clone, leaving the aggressive clone behind to actually proliferate and become a real issue?
That is a huge issue in multiple myeloma, and we know that at presentation of any myeloma, there is about 6 or 7 clones at diagnosis, even in MGUS stage and smoldering stage. And your point is very well taken. Actually, about 5 years ago, we have reported on smoldering patients that we treated with Revlimid Dex followed by transplant, and within a couple of months, the smoldering patient, one had plasma cell leukemia and one had aggressive relapse with PET positivity, and actually we published that. And actually the debate was, are we doing harm on those trials? And it is a very good point, because sometimes patients can leave some aggressive clones behind. And that's really one of the attractive aspects of the ASCENT trial. The ASCENT trial is treating smoldering myeloma patients more aggressively than we treat myeloma patients.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving them daratumumab, carfilzomib, Revlimid, dexamethasone. And the question is, why are you giving a pre-malignant condition more aggressive treatment than you give to your regular myeloma? And the concept is just what you just said. Try to attack different clones, and more importantly, try to impact on the disease biology to cure multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma is still incurable malignancy, and that's why trying to intervene early, aggressively, can we change the biology of the disease? We know now that if you give patients lenalidomide or Revlimid with dexamethasone to smoldering patients, you can prolong their survival. But it's very clear from what's published that you don't actually cure
the disease. Eradicate the disease.
Mm-hmm. And now attempts are being a little bit more aggressive. Can we actually impact this different clones and eliminate the disease? The trial started, as I said, we have enroll 2 patients. We'll see where we go from here.
Yeah, well, it's an incredible concept.
No, it's an incredible concept, but such a trial requires, it's a commitment for us because we have to treat those patients, but also requires motivated patients. Let's say, okay, I understand the risks, I understand the benefits. Consenting patients on this trial takes much more time from all of us than it takes for myeloma patients, because you have to explain the benefits, expected risks, side effects of drugs, and the goal of treatment. And it's a trial that, believe it or not, most of the time patients will tell me, I'd like to go on this trial, rather than me telling them, I'd like you to go on this trial.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a whole other aspect to that, too. It's a time commitment for patients. It's, you know, it becomes an expense, and you have additional co-pays and things of that nature. But on the flip coin, you're getting all of these, the best possible drugs in the toolbox, and you're getting them early and at no cost. So, you know, there's pros, there's cons, and it's really intriguing because I have a smoldering myeloma group, and a lot of us have been looking at it, and some have actually applied for it but didn't meet the criteria. So, you know, and that's a good thing too. It's a good part of the trial because they're really being very, very specific about the population that they're capturing and making certain that they truly are these super high risk smoldering myeloma patients and capturing the right patients. So that's wonderful.
I just would like to emphasize that point because you're absolutely right. This particular trial is designed for high-risk smoldering patients that, with what we know today, have an 80% chance of progressing to multiple myeloma or 50% chance of progressing to multiple myeloma at 2 years. And that's why the criteria is a little bit more strict with the M-spike, the kappa-lambda ratio, and the bone marrow percentage, not to give it to patients that will have a chance of staying in remission without any intervention for a long time. It's a high-risk smoldering trial.
Right, very good. Well, sir, thank you so much for your time. Jenny, thank you for allowing me to ask all these questions. I appreciate you both, and I wish you a wonderful day. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dana. And Dr. Pedros, Dana's questions about smoldering myeloma and MGUS, I just have a follow-up question for that. So when you look at the African-American community, for these, and now that these earlier precursor condition studies are being run, what is your opinion on potentially earlier treatment specifically for the African American community?
I think it's an opportunity, actually. I think it's an opportunity for African American patients with disease that can cause damage if you don't treat it to go on those trials. I have to admit the first two patients are Caucasians, and I am hoping to be able to reach the African-American community to go on those trials. It will be a challenge with all the ramifications of why start treatment when I have no problems to what is the goal. And as I said before, each patient should determine his selected treatment course. Our job is to give options, understand the disease, understand the treatment, and respect whatever decision they make. If a patient wants to be followed without treatment, I will follow them without treatment. I'll not be upset if they don't go on my clinical trial. I will be more than happy to follow them and initiate treatment when indicated. But in general, I think it's a huge opportunity, and I think any high-risk African-American patients who have this condition should seriously consider a clinical trial like the one we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something the HealthTree tool that I mentioned earlier can help do also to kind of assess maybe options you might want to consider and then go take it to a myeloma specialist or your doctor and have that conversation because you can do that without and do that from home.
Actually,
one more caller question. Go ahead.
Just an important point, Jenny. Treating smoldering myeloma is an experimental treatment. It's not the treatment that can be given in the community. And really, we are against giving smoldering myeloma patients treatment off protocol. So I don't want the idea that, okay, I have early disease, let me treat it somewhere and get a remission. I think if it's going to be done, it should be done on protocol so we understand the ramifications of what we're doing. Will it negatively impact the outcome, positively impact the outcome? What side effects to accept or not accept in this more or less pre-malignant condition?
Yeah, that's a critical point, very critical point. Okay, we have one last caller at 990-1090. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dr. Badros.
Hi.
Hi. Listening to your today's been really enlightening, and I have just two quick questions that have nothing to do with each other. One is it occurs to me listening to you, you know, we've been talking about the disparities between African-American and Caucasian populations. It occurs to me in listening to you over and over again today that black males are a disparity within a disparity. Are there other disparities within the disparity of the African-American community that we need to be paying attention to? So that's the first question. And the second question is rather boring. The other thing I keep hearing over and over again is the preference of local doctors. And the other thing I hear is that you do get patients referred to you, but they're referred late. Can you give us maybe an example or two, just a practical example of how you interact with local doctors where you think it works really well, and that would might be a model for how specialists like you can work with local physicians? And those are my two questions. Thank you.
About disparity within disparity. I think. I think it's mostly socioeconomic. Level of education, income, occupation affects the decisions to come to us. So, and that's really across races. If you're white or black and you have no insurance, it's very difficult to get to a tertiary center for transplant, for example. In our community, we are really lucky because we are close to Washington, very educated African-American population, and most of them have above-average income. So I don't see that problem once you start equalizing the socioeconomic factors and education. It will fall back to what I just mentioned about favorable markers genetically and giving the same treatment. So it is really probably social, and I am, as I said previously, probably much better understanding of socioeconomic factors or a discussion about access to care, which is a huge issue in our healthcare system today, and barriers to that system is probably worth maybe a meeting with someone who understands that stuff, and Jenny, I'm sure, can find people that know that stuff better than me. So as far as the bias of physicians or referral pattern, I think in our area here, I think we have a very collegial relationship with the community physicians. We are very lucky that I live in Baltimore with about six world-renowned institutions around us. All of them have physicians trained with our center or with Hopkins, NIH, George Washington, Georgetown, Howard. So you actually have a very highly educated pool of physicians. So our city doesn't lack the sophisticated physician pool. I give my numbers to physicians. They can call me directly when they see a myeloma case. I always offer a trial if it's available. If the trial is not available, I respect the physician who referred the case, and I always recommend treatment close to home. And I would like to see the patient usually either before they start treatment or within one cycle of treatment to see how things are going, and I recommend change of treatment if I suspect it's an aggressive case or the treatment is inadequate. A lot of times nowadays we get phone calls because physicians don't really know, okay, should I give Velcade twice a week, once a week? How are you guys giving carfilzomib? It's two times a week, once a week. What dose you give, 27, 36, 56, 70? So the myeloma community and physicians, we are making it very difficult for people to have a cookbook to go by, so they have to use us. And we are a transplant center, so we usually get referrals for transplant as well as older myeloma. That being said, our community opens a lot of clinical trials for myeloma patients, and we support that, especially elder patients that we see frequently. We open trials for elder patients, randomized trials for patients over age 75 or those ineligible for transplant. And I hate to say it, but most of those trials enroll one or two or three patients, and patients, either for many reasons, again, socioeconomic, most of it, cannot go on those trials. That's all.
Okay, great. Thank you for your question, and thank you for your answer. Dr. Bedros, thank you so much. We've kept you way over time today, but we're very grateful that you stayed with us. We'd like to remind everybody about the Louisville meeting on Saturday morning, this coming Saturday. If you're in the area and you would like to join us, it will be a very informative day, talking about some basics about myeloma, financial resources, and things that the African American community can be particularly helped with. And we would just like to say thank you so much for participating and sharing your important work with us
today.
Thank you,
Jennifer, for the opportunity.
Well, we're very, very grateful for you. And we'd like to thank our listeners for listening to Myeloma Crowd Radio to learn more about myeloma research and what it means for you.